Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your host, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
And welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II based podcast. We want to thank each and every one of you for joining us for another episode and another week. We want to thank everybody who supports this show through Patreon. Simply go to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on the Patreon link, sign up. It's $1 a month. There's some other plans, but we don't care about those. We'll be happy with the $1 a month plan. So if you want to support what we do here at the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, please head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com and sign up for Patreon. Welcome back, Jeff Copsetta. How are you doing, friend?
Yeah, good. I'm excited to be back. Sorry I missed last week, but you know how it goes.
It's all good. You're a super busy guy. You brought new life into the world. You're bettering yourself. You're trying to be a little delicate about this. You're helping other people with their projects and trying to get that off the ground. And so you've just been a super busy guy.
Yeah.
But returning to the podcast, it feels like it's more than just episode number two, because you've done an episode of her show, I've done an episode of her show, and so we've all been together a few times now. But returning to the show, you know her from Instagram as well as our YouTube channel at HistoryChick1941, host of History Behind the Page, Sarah the History Chick. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
You know, an effort, because I knew you were going to talk about the USS Indianapolis tonight. I was going to wear my Navy jacket, but it's just too damn hot here, so that lasts all 5.5 minutes. I put forth an effort. It's the only time I actually get to wear that thing. I don't even have a Navy impression. I just bought this at World War II impression because it was on sale, and it works great in the rain. But anyhow, how are things with you?
Things are good. I don't know, same old, just doing the history behind the page and posting history nerd stuff. That's pretty much my life. So
she says
very exciting.
She says that all nonchalantly, Jeff, but you know, as well as I do from watching on Instagram and TikTok, she's just constantly putting out content. It's always video after video after interview after interview. So things seem to be blowing up over there.
Yeah, I mean, she's sensational at what she does, and she's got congratulations on 2,500 viewers, because that makes you, or followers. I guess that makes you about 250 times cooler than me, at least. So, we love what you do, and you're really good at it. So that definitely helps.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, on the inaugural episode that you had joined us with, we found out late in the podcast that your little niche, your little thing, the little bug in your ear, we all have one, is not only, like, you know, not a broad stroke like Navy or this particular, it's the USS Indianapolis. And so we thought, well, it's close enough to the anniversary, and so why not bring you on, make you do all the heavy lifting? Me and Jeff will lean back and just collect the praise and have some content and let you do all the work. So without any further ado, take it away. No, real quick, before what is it about the USS Indianapolis? How did that become your little side corner amongst this big hobby?
So it was probably back in like 2017. I was on a documentary binge on Amazon Prime, and at the time I was on a USS Arizona binge and watched a bunch of documentaries on there. And then Prime was like, you know, documentaries like the one you just watched. And they had a documentary called the USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. And I was like, oh, you know, that sounds, the USS Indianapolis. I was like, I've heard of it. I don't know the story. And I said, it looks really familiar. Well, a year prior, my mom had bought me a book at Goodwill called In Harm's Way by Doug Stanton. It's the story of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. So I was like, oh, well, I'm going to watch this. And then I went on those magnificent rabbit holes and, you know, watched the documentary, The Legacy, and heard the survivor stories, and then watched the documentary because Paul Allen found the remains of the USS Indianapolis in August of 2017. And then I watched the movie Mission of the Shark, where Stacy Keach plays Captain McVeigh. It's about the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. And for some reason, I just got so hooked with the USS Indianapolis for some reason. And
then cross-platform promotions kicked in, and you start getting some suggestions from the scene from Jaws when they're sitting in the booth getting drunk on your YouTube channel. You're like, what's this?
So that's kind of how my little weird obsession with the U.S. Indianapolis started.
Well, that's the thing about obsessions. That's, you know, that's why we call it the little bug in your ear, because for everybody, it's something different. You'll be reading something and all day, some reason that one particular thing, and then you read more and then there's something even deeper and then deeper. And so that's the fascinating thing about the hobby that we all care about so much. So why don't you go ahead and school us, if you will, on the USS Indianapolis. Yeah.
So the anniversary of the sinking is Saturday, July 30th, is when the Indy was sunk. So if most people don't know, the USS Indianapolis, she was a Portland class cruiser. She had been in the war for a really long time. She did the bombardment in Okinawa. She was at the Battle of the Philippine Sea. She was damaged by a kamikaze pilot, by a kamikaze plane. Like, just so much stuff that India's been through before she was tasked with this mission that ended up being her last mission. And after the Trinity test in the Manhattan Project, the successful test of the atomic bomb, the USS Indianapolis was chosen to deliver the key components of the atomic bomb to the island of Tinian. It was extremely top secret. Not even the captain really knew what was on board. After that, they were going to be starting to do training exercises for what they thought was the inevitable invasion of Japan. So they ended up traveling to the island of Tinian and made it in record timing. They were probably going about 33 miles per hour, which is really fast for for a ship.
Sure.
And you know, they made it to Tinian. Let me back up a little bit. Sorry.
Sure.
Captain McVeigh got the orders to transfer this top secret package. At the beginning, he was like, okay, I'm transferring this top secret package. It's very important. It's under lock and key. It's under armed guard. You know, July 1945, he goes, can I get an escort? And the Navy told him no, because the Navy said that they had been doing recon missions. There was no Japanese enemies. He didn't need an escort. He's like, I think I need an escort. And he asked a few times and he was told no. And so they load up the package. They sail to Tinian. They get there pretty quick. They get there by July 26th and drop off the package. Well, little did they know, they were carrying about half the United States supply of uranium on the USS Indianapolis. Nobody knew exactly what was in the package. The guys on the ship thought it was 50,000 rolls of scented toilet paper for General MacArthur. They were having bets. They thought it was new airplane engine parts, just so many different stuff. So it was just kind of a regular mission. No, they didn't come across any Japanese enemies or anything in the water. And well, they went to Tinian.
Let me pause right there real quick. Hindsight being what it is, is there any theories by the armchair quarterbacks of today, the modern day historians, the people who have time to look into research? Is there any conspiracy theories, any just out there heads up of why people think that the Navy or even the Army Air Corps was reluctant to provide any sort of cover for these guys?
There's no conspiracies per se that I've come across. It's a lot of the same repetitiveness of just laziness, of miscommunication, of just, you know, people, it was towards the end of the war. They didn't know the war was going to be ending. Everybody was battle fatigued. They were this drug out war. Laziness, miscommunication, that's kind of the big thing.
I didn't know if maybe they thought, well, A, the more cover we have, the more boats out there, the more likelihood of getting spotted. B, maybe the more cover, the slower. If we send them out there by themselves, they can just haul ass and get there quicker. I didn't know if it was something as simple as that, or maybe they thought, well, okay, if things go south and this thing blows up, we don't want to lose a bunch of equipment surrounding it. I mean, I don't know what the stable... go ahead.
I don't know how stable uranium is, too, if it gets, you know, hit by a torpedo or anything. But you would think that if the Navy knew, you know, that the higher ups knew, they're like, they're carrying the key components of the atomic bomb of Little Boy. This is very important. This is hopefully going to end the war. You think that they would have gave them an escort because of how important that package is. Yeah. That's almost half of the United States supply of uranium. If they lost that, like, before it got dropped off, like, that's kind of a big deal. The outcome of the war would have changed probably very dramatically, you know? So Yeah. It was just weird.
That just, yeah. And it's hard to believe that the commander of the ship wouldn't at least be given some kind of intel. I mean, I understand the top secret, but at his rank, he should have a top secret clearance. And I mean, again, to travel by yourself, there's got to be some kind of contingency plan. And if you don't know what's in the package, I don't know. That's crazy to operate that way. But I don't know Navy stuff.
Off the top of my head, I don't think that he knew exactly like the importance of what he was carrying. If I remember correctly, but I'm sure if I'm wrong, somebody will correct me. Yeah, but okay. So, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But yeah, so they dropped off this package at the package at Tinian, and then they went over to Guam. They sailed over to Guam, and a lot of some of the sailors were, their tour had ended, so they switched out and were refueling, and were going to go meet up with the USS the USS Idaho at the island of Leyte, and then they were going to go join Task Force 95 and start, which the USS Nevada, the USS California was out there. They were going to do training exercises for the invasion of Japan. That's what they were supposed to be doing, until this little submarine called the I-58 was lurking in the waters and changed their narrative, to say the least. And the story of the USS Indianapolis and the sinking unfolds here. So the crazy thing is that they actually had intel that there were Japanese submarines in the water on the route of where they were heading to Leyte. And so I don't know, the whole communication and the way it went about, it's one of the largest naval disasters in U.S. military history, loss of life. It's weird that there was no escort, and then the communication towards the end once the Indy got sunk is a really tragic story. So let's get to the sinking. So on the night of July 30th,
let me pause you right there. I want to just to slow things down real quick, because we were able, there was a little miscommunication part of the show. Henry is joining us right now, so we're just going to hang out and let Henry come in. There was a little miscommunication. I thought he was unable to join tonight, but he's actually coming in now. So here he is now. And that's why I didn't want you to think I was ignoring you. I was actually getting the information so I can send Henry an invite. Henry, I do apologize due to the miscommunication. We thought you were unable to attend tonight. But we just got to the section of our show where Sarah was explaining the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. So we are live now. Can you hear us all right?
Yeah, I got you.
Oh, no worries.
Henry, you'd make a great Marine. Thanks for joining us.
You guys are T-shirt pals.
I was like, what the hell, man? Are we not on tonight or what?
No, we're on. No, that was my fault. But anyhow, so we are right at the part where we're getting
back
into
to breakdown in communication.
But we are thrilled to have the whole crew back together again.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead, Sarah.
So, first off, Henry, it's good to see you again.
Yeah. How are you? I mean, guys, if you don't want me to be here for this double date, just tell me. I mean, you know.
We've had enough of you, Henry. It's time to go.
Yeah, wouldn't be the first time.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so Sarah, story time. So on the morning of July 30th, 1945, about 15 minutes after midnight, the I-58 saw the USS Indianapolis and let off torpedoes. Two of those torpedoes struck the Indianapolis on her starboard side. It hit the bow of the ship, and then it hit the middle of the ship, and it completely almost annihilated the Indy. Her bow completely exploded. Everybody below deck, everybody in the sick bay, they were pretty much covered in fire. They had fuel storage on there that caused a massive explosion from the second torpedo. They had ammunition that exploded that almost tore the Indy completely in half. When the first torpedo hit, Captain McVeigh was actually in his bunk and felt her shake. And he didn't know what was going on. Not a lot of people knew what was going on. And he finally got word that the ship had been hit. And so he tried to call an SOS signal out. But by that time, they had already lost power from when the second torpedo hit. And he sent out 3 distress signals. And he wasn't sure if they got out or not, but he kept trying. And finally, after a couple minutes, he gave the order to abandon ship. The Indy sunk in just 12 minutes from when the first torpedo hit. And people think 12 minutes is not a long time. It's kind of a long time. It's actually not. It's super fast, especially when the ship is tilting over and almost in half is flooding. Men were jumping off the ship, and it sank. It tipped over and it sank. When they abandoned the ship, it sank so fast that men were walking off the deck of the ship into the water, just like you walk into the ocean from the beach. They just stepped off the deck right into the ocean.
Yeah, I was going to say 12 minutes. The speed of 12 minutes is relative to what level of that boat you're on when it's going down.
Yeah, and it was insane. Men were covered in oil. They were burned from the explosion. They were injured. There was 1,195 men of the USS Indianapolis. 300 went down with the ship, and about 890 went in the water. The ship went down so fast that they weren't able to get so many lifeboats, life preservers. And the way that they all went in the water and the way that the current was going, the way that the ship was going, all these groups, people ended up floating out really far apart. So they tried to get into these little groups as quick as they could. But it was pitch black. It was dark. 1 minute they're on the ship. Now they're in the water and they have no idea what to do next. And, people were fighting for life vests. People were trying to get on, you know, lifeboats. They were in, I can't remember what these little net things are called, but they were, you know, tying nets to each other to get people out of the water. And at that time they weren't really panicking, because they thought they were going to be rescued very shortly. And unfortunately, that was not the case. And that's where the lack of communication comes in a little later. But daybreak came. And this is where the tragic twist of the story comes, where you don't think about this stuff when you are on a ship like the Indy. You don't think about sharks in the water because you're on a ship.
Yeah.
Why would you think about sharks? And that became a very deadly predator for the survivors of the Indianapolis. They came in the morning, really early in the morning when the sun was rising, and they came right at twilight when the sun was just setting. But,
you know, I don't think I don't want to pass the shark thing real quick. I was just, as you're talking, I was things in my mind. I don't think we stopped to think about this, but we're late in the war, you know, 45. We're in the Pacific area throughout the ocean. And at this time, many of ships, whether American or Japanese, have been sank. Mm-hmm. And we do know, if anybody who's into hunting, fishing, or just watching documentaries on animals have a learned behavior. And I don't know if maybe anybody's put any thought into this, but possibly by this time of the war, the sharks may have learned that, hey, if you feel this big shock wave, as tends to happen when ships explode, and you hear this noise, they may have learned through experience that, hey, that's a food source. And so by this time of the war, maybe, it's all hypothetical, but you almost wonder if this explosion would have happened earlier in the war, if there would have been as many sharks. Because we know they can smell blood for miles. We know they can hear for miles. And we know through animals and learned behavior, they, at that point in war, hey, you felt the rattle, you hear the sound, that's a food source, let's go. And it's very scary to think about it like that, too. Because, I mean, that would imply that the amount of sharks that are there would have been more than anywhere else earlier in the war. If the hypothesis that I just thought of while you're talking about this, but because, I don't know, just the Indianapolis is the one that we hear the most about the shark stuff, opposed to other sinkings where they've pulled survivors out of the water. I don't know if maybe because they spent more time in the water, but you know, when people hear about the USS Indianapolis, they automatically think sharks. So I just, just stumbled across that while you were talking about it. I was like, well, that's an interesting hypothesis, at least.
I mean, that very well could be. I was never one to watch Shark Week at all on the Discovery Channel, but so I don't know that much about sharks. But that, I mean, that could very well be. I'm not 100% sure.
Well, not to go too far in tangent, but I'll just a little point of proof. Anybody who watches Demolition Ranch on YouTube, he has a new property out in Texas. And recently, every time they're out there shooting, the deer come. Because they know when they hear shooting, he's usually shooting at watermelons, Cool Whip, food items. So they have learned when they hear the gunshots on his range, there's food to be had. And so if you kind of stretch out into the shark world, it would kind of make sense because, once again, learned behavior. They've learned, hey, when this guy's shooting his guns, there might be watermelon chunks or Cool Whip. And so they actually flock. He has to stop his videos because the deer start walking on his gun range. So there's kind of a proof of a theory there anyhow.
Yeah. I could see that. I mean, it's just like when I feed my dog, she hears a certain sound. She's like, oh, my God, I'm food.
I don't know if one of our listeners would know the answer to this. I don't know if you know the answer to this, or maybe Jeff or Henry, but you're talking about they tried to send out a distress signal, but the power went out. Do you guys know if most of their power came directly from the generators or alternators and they didn't have much battery storage? Or would the batteries have ran out that quickly after being hit that they would have instantly lost power? Or power quicker than they would anticipate it, so they couldn't send the distress signal.
Right off, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm assuming when she's talking about the lack of power, the distress signals are probably what, flares or something like that, you know, that you don't need power.
No, he sent out, he called,
he tried to send out an SOS to the radio, but the gear was down.
SOS. Yeah.
Prior to losing power.
Like right before they lost power is when he set out. He wasn't sure if they lost power when he sent it out, if he had power while he was doing it. Wasn't sure, but the power was pretty quickly goodbye.
I'm sure one of our listeners is one of those guys. That's their thing, is the mechanics of vessels in World War II. So I'm sure someone can email us a mail call at WTSP World War II. Let us know, you know, do they run off generators? Did they have a battery bank? Were they able to run off battery for not just in Indianapolis, but that type of vessel in general? Be interesting to find out. But
maybe we have a marine biologist that's listening too. That can
answer the learned behavior of sharks.
Sharks.
But anyhow, Sarah, go ahead.
Oh yeah. So their first day in the water was pretty scary, but they still weren't 100% panicked yet. Cause they thought, okay, distress signal went out. You know, they should know that we haven't checked in. We should be rescued very soon. Come to find out that would not be the case. You know, they kept seeing planes fly over, while they were in the water, but you know, the planes were so high up, they couldn't see them. But that's when the shark attack started happening, is when they finally really started to notice. They say about 150 men were the victims of shark attacks. And the survivors could say, you could look down in the crystal clear water and you could see them just circling about 15 feet below you. They would get so close up that they would like bump the guys' legs, and it was very much sneak attack. They would say that, you know, they would see somebody just floating in the water. You'd see their head and they would just disappear. And that happened frequently. They didn't know when it was going to happen. They did get to a time frame of early morning. And then also when the sun was setting is when usually they would attack. But so about 890 men went in the water. A lot of them were badly burnt from the explosion. They were injured. They were covered in oil. This is when the other bad part of being in the water set in: dehydration, sun poisoning, exhaustion, all this other stuff played so many factors when you are in salt water, what it does to the skin and how fast it dehydrates you, plus the skin, plus the sun, plus you have no fresh water.
Yeah.
You can't drink salt water.
Dehydrate
salt water
you.
Dehydrates you. People, the men of the Indy were having delusions. They were going insane. They were hallucinating. Some actually tried to drink the water and saying this is fresh water. And some saw islands and swam to the island that they imagined, you know, that they thought they saw, and they ended up drowning of exhaustion. And with the guys who were on the rafts, you know, they pretty much stayed there. And then the guys had life preservers who were in the water too. The thing with the life preservers back then is the material they were made out of, they get really waterlogged. So they're not designed to be in the water for long periods of time. So a lot of the men started to drown and sink in these life vests, keeping themselves afloat. And so it became super scary and super, super tragic. And the ones who were getting picked off by sharks were the ones who were the injured, who were the weak. And kind of just like what Don said, I feel like the sharks probably knew like this person is the weakest person, you know, he's the easiest target. And they were in the water for almost 3 days, almost 4 days, until they finally got spotted. And when they got spotted, there was a PV Ventura flown by Wilbur Chuck Gwynn. And he was just out there flying around and he noticed these little specks in the water. And he was like, what are those? He goes, those are people in the water. And he goes, he didn't know if they were Japanese, if they were enemy or if they were friendly. And he goes, well, they can't be friendly because we have no reports of a ship missing. So who are these people? So he ends up radioing back to his commander and he goes, I'm going to start doing a rescue effort. And he told him, no, he doesn't have enough fuel. He needs to come back to base. So he started tossing out supplies to the survivors of the Indianapolis. So life vests, rafts, and then he started tossing out containers of fresh water. But the thing is, tossing out containers of water that high up, by the time it hit the water of the ocean, it completely broke.
There's pretty much wooden barrels, right?
There were wooden barrels. Yeah, yeah, there were wooden kegs of water. And so, you know, but he was panicking and trying to get everything out. And that is when Lieutenant Adrian Marks heard the call come out that there are survivors of something in the water. And he got in his PBY and he flew to where the coordinates were that Gwynn gave him. And he saw just heads in the water. And he told his commander, he goes, I'm going to land my plane and start a rescue mission. They told him no. They go, you're not allowed to do it. And I think he wasn't allowed to do it because they knew if he landed that PBY in that part of the water that the plane was going to be destroyed. They didn't want to lose a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just all these little things happened. Well, he did end up landing the plane and his plane became inoperable once he landed it. The swells of the waves were so high. And he started pulling out rescuers of Indianapolis and he got about 40 to 50 people inside the plane, which that is super cramped. And then there was no room. The plane started to be really weighted. So he said the survivors who had more energy, who were more healthy, can we start strapping you to the wings of the plane? So he started strapping survivors of the USS Indianapolis with parachute cords to the wings of the plane.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so when that distress signal came out from Gwynn and Adrian Marks, it alerted a huge rescue effort from ships all over. One of the two main rescue ships was the USS Cecil Doyle and the USS Bassett. They hauled but to get to where they were. It took over 24 hours to pull all the survivors out of the water because they were the groups were so spread out miles and miles away because of the current and when mm-hmm. they left the ship that it took them, you know, a while to get all the survivors. Of the 900 to 890 men that went in the water, only 316 were pulled out.
I think in that documentary you mentioned earlier, some of the survivors mm-hmm. had survivor's guilt because they had floated and survived with their group for so long. And that mm-hmm. when the rescue started, as tends to happen when you're on water, things look closer than they actually are. And so, that's only a few hundred yards away. Let's swim for it. And in that documentary, they explained that if they would have sat there and waited, they believe that more of their friends would have survived. But by kind of convincing them to swim for it, quote unquote, they basically got exhaustion and drowned, not being able to support their weight anymore, trying to swim to the rescue ships.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, at that point, you're dehydrated, you're scared, you know, you see hope, and you're not in the clear state of mind. And that happened, I think, to the three of the men who were in the water who didn't make it to the Cecil Doyle. They did not make it. They just, but a huge rescue effort came underway. They were pulling, you know, survivors out. And I remember one of the survivors saying, you know, mind you, they had been in salt water for almost 4 days. They were dehydrated. They were asking the men to climb up on the rope ladders. And they're like, yeah, I can totally do that, you know. And they were climbing up on the rope ladders, and they were so exhausted and so injured that their skin just started to peel off because it was so dry. And they ended up having to hoist a bunch of the survivors, having to pull them up from the water. That's how, you know, you don't realize your injuries sustain when you're sitting in water for so long until you finally get on dry land and you're like, oh, this doesn't feel good. And, you know, I'm completely falling apart.
Yeah, essentially been sitting, you think your hands look bad after sitting in a bathtub for an hour and a half. Imagine being in there for 4 days and then in the salt, and then to be that buoyant, and then, as you said, try to climb a rope ladder or a net, all 118, 120 pounds of you, that's going to rip right off.
Yeah, so, you know, they hoisted all the survivors that they could pull up onto the, I think the Cecil, or it was the Bassett, I'm so blanking on this. One of them had 151 of the, pulled up 151 of the survivors, and I think it was the Bassett, but it could have been the Doyle, but I'm just blanking right now. But yeah, they had a bunch of different ships that just came to the call, and when they pulled the first survivor on the Cecil Doyle, he goes, son, where are you from? And he goes, we're from the USS Indianapolis. And he's like, what do you mean? He goes, yeah, we're from the Indianapolis. He goes, we didn't know the Indianapolis sunk. And so that was the first time that the survivors knew. They go, wow, nobody was coming from us. Nobody knew we were missing. Nobody knew of anything. And so thanks to, you know, Chuck Gwynn and Adrian Marks, they were able to round up the the whole, you know, Navy and get people to rescue the survivors.
So going from Guam to Leyte, that was the route that they were on, right?
They already dropped off the uranium at Tinian. They were heading, they stopped at Guam, did kind of like a swap of people who were done with their tour and, you know, restocked, refueled, all that stuff. And then they were heading over to Leyte to go start doing training maneuvers with the Task Force 95 to train for the invasion of Japan. And because they were on a top secret mission, and they deemed the USS Indianapolis such a strong ship.
You can never go wrong with a vessel.
I don't know why I just said boat. Anyways, she kind of got a little bit of leeway, so they weren't surprised that she didn't check in. But that is actually what doomed the Indianapolis in the end, and where the miscommunication came in.
So yeah, that's kind of part of my, I kind of have a twofold question for you. So to me, once the cargo was dropped off at Tinian, the top secret